There are some subjects in the scriptures where people take sides, and often the attempt to discuss and reason with them turns into a battle. I think we've all seen that, talking to denominational people about baptism or instrumental music or once saved, always saved. Talking with the Jehovah Witnesses about their convictions. And although we try to reason and we try to think calmly and easily about it in order to keep it from going there, oftentimes it spirals out of control, hopefully and usually because of them not appreciating the understanding of what we are trying to teach them. And so, as I say, there are certain topics that create this. And through the years, one of the topics that has become this is this particular verse. I've had to talk with different people through the years because of their lax attendance. And, of course, this lesson is going to lay it all out to the best that I know how. There are some things about attendance that we don't really have the ability to judge or pass judgment on other people. But when it goes on and on and on, after a while, you feel like at least we need to discuss this to try to come to a meeting of the minds on where our priorities are. I've never withdrawn or even sought to withdraw from anyone over or forsaking the assembly because it's something that each individual is dealing with in their own way. But at the same time, I think we do need to reason together, and I think we do need to set aside whatever prejudice we have and just take a look at the scriptures. And that's what I've tried to do the last few weeks, and that's what we're going to do this morning. And again, I say battle because it's just not a neutral subject. And basically it comes down to this. Is the forsaking of the assembly a single time? If I don't come today and I don't have a good reason, did I violate Hebrews 10:25? Or do I have to do it again and again and again and again, 50 times, 100 times, I don't know how many times, but at some point the threshold gets passed in the minds of that individual. And so this is where the question comes in. Is every single forsaking of the assembly a violation of this verse? Or does it take a complete apostasy, a complete and final apostasy? Now, over the last few months, I've been studying with an individual about this subject, and this was their position. And they have proclaimed that the position of this congregation, and I don't even know what that position is. I only know what my position is. I've never seen the church's position. But we have been slandered and attacked, and so this morning I want to try to lay out exactly where we stand on this, or at least where I stand on this, and hopefully, I think if this is the case, we will all come to a meeting of the minds and we'll all come to an agreement. And so we need to have a calm and deliberate, logical, spiritual reasoning about the example of the Sabbath. About the penalty of not taking the Lord's Supper properly versus the penalty for forsaking, about the definition of forsaking, about the definition of custom and manner, and then how does Jesus demand that we assess our priorities as far as whether or not being here is the most critical thing, or whether or what we can justify to not come. And I think we all have different thresholds on that as far as how important we think this assembly is. And that will lead us into the last one, which is how does Jesus explain these priorities? And he uses the Sabbath day. And he explains that there are reasons why you can, quote, violate the Sabbath. You can work on the Sabbath if your ox falls into a ditch. If the priests have to circumcise or they have to offer the sacrifices on that day. And so the Lord will help us to kind of navigate through this because there are situations. As Rob just announced, Virgil's not here today. He's not sick. Is that a violation of the forsaking the assembly? Or is that one of these situations that Jesus explains, and we'll get to this again, as I said, at the very end of the lesson. So as we begin, and I'm not going to spend much time on this one because we covered it in the last 2 weeks, but Paul says in Colossians chapter 2 that the Sabbath is a type and shadow of good things to come, which means we have to look at it and we have to try to understand, in what way is it a shadow? In what way is it a type? What is it about God demanding that the children of Israel take the entire seventh day to remember that he created them in six days and rested on the seventh day, and that he delivered them from Egypt? And interestingly enough, we remember the Lord's death, the Lord's body and blood. And so there are some definite similarities there. And when Peter preached to Israel and they started coming into the kingdom, obviously their view of the Sabbath is going to be reflected in their view of the importance of assembling on the first day of the week. So they knew it was not a complete desertion of the Sabbath, but a single violation of the Sabbath that brought death. So comparing the penalty of the Lord's Supper violation, which again, I think that's a single event. I think that if I this morning let my mind wander, thought about my projects, thought about my upcoming vacation, thought about what it is that I'd like to be doing, if my mind is flitting all over, then I have taken the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner, and I'm guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. It doesn't have to be a continuous thing. If you do it once, you're guilty of this. So he who drinks, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner, Sunday by Sunday by Sunday, will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. You don't have to do this every time. You don't have to do this for months if you do it one time. He who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself. So Paul is very clear that if we partake of the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner, one time, we're guilty. So they knew this was a single event. So then we come to the condemnation and punishment for forsaking. Now the argument that I think is just irrefutable is, if we come here and we take the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner, we're guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. What if we don't come at all? What if the Lord's Supper is so unimportant to us that not only do we not take it in a worthy manner, we don't even feel the need to come? And again, is that one time or multiple times? Well, the penalty, which is again very comparable to being guilty of the body and blood of the Lord, is to trample the Son of God underfoot. So we see that the Sabbath and the Lord's Day have some similarities. We see that the penalty for misusing the Lord's Supper and forsaking the assembly have similarities. Now, is that enough to draw a conclusion? I don't think so. But I think it's evidence. So let's look now at the definition of forsaking. The term, and again, I'm not going to go into this in great detail. Just look at the yellow. To forsake, abandon, leave in straits, or helpless. To abandon and desert. To forsake, leave behind in any place or state. And then the root word is forsake, abandon, leave in the lurch. Now, as you read that, are you thinking single event or are you thinking total apostasy? Well, as we look at that, well, I think we could go either way. So the definitions actually, I think, leave two options. The first is, it could be a permanent forsaking. It could be that the Hebrew writer is only addressing those Christians who never return. They forsake and they're never going to return. And that's who he's talking about there. That's definitely a possibility, but it can also be a more limited forsaking. Because being left in the lurch doesn't have to be global. It can be a single time. And I give this illustration. If I promise to pick you up at the airport and I forget, you're left in the lurch. You're abandoned. You're in straits. But just for that day. As soon as you call me and say, look, I thought you said, oh, I'm really sorry, I forgot. I'll be right there. Well, did I abandon? Yeah. Yeah, we abandoned. I don't think there's any question about that. So here's the question, as we look at the balancing here, is forsaking final and complete, and you could never be guilty. You could miss as many times as you want, as long as you had the intention to return, you could not violate this verse. Now, that is the argument that we were hearing. You can't use Hebrews 10 for single forsakings, regardless of the reason. I'm going to go and I'll watch a parade today. I'm going to play cards with someone today. I'm going to go to dinner with my mom and dad today. Well, that's not Hebrews 10, because unless you were doing it permanently, you couldn't violate this verse. I have a serious problem with that, but let's talk about why. When Jesus was on the cross, he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's the exact same word as Hebrews. Do you see Jesus here saying, why have you abandoned me forever and ever, never to return? How could he say that when all of the prophecies have revealed that as soon as he died, he would become the king and priest on his throne? He knew he wasn't being abandoned forever, but he was certainly left in the lurch on the cross, even though he prayed in the garden, not my will, but your will be done. He knew that he was going to have to face that moment alone without the help of the Father. The Father had left him. And so Jesus was not proclaiming a permanent forsaking. I just don't see how you could do that. The same with the second one. The second one is in Acts chapter 2, where it says, you will not leave my soul in Hades. Now, it's impossible to be completely abandoned forever in Hades, because Hades is going to be open and people are going to come out. You can't be abandoned there. And David never implied that. What he meant was, you are not going to abandon my soul there and let my body see corruption. This is going to be a momentary thing. The next one, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. And at my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me. Now, is Paul saying about all the Romans that they have left me in the lurch forever? They're never coming back. They have totally apostatized. They wouldn't stand with me. Or is he saying, they left me in the lurch because of this trial? And the same thing with Demas. I don't know. I've thought a lot about this through the years, whether Demas had forsaken Paul like these people in 2 Timothy, or whether he completely apostatized. And of course, we'll have to wait. But love would demand that we put the best possible motive. And I hope that Demas was not forsaking the Lord, but just had decided he didn't want to work and do what Paul was doing anymore. Kind of like John Mark. John Mark left them in the lurch, but not forever, just for that one moment. So these are the ways that it's used. Here's one last one. He himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? Now, those are the only uses of it in the New Testament. And I think you can see that you could make a legitimate case that it can be an individual, single day, or it could be complete and total. It kind of balances out, but as we look at this one, I think this one's really important. Is God saying here, I'm never going to completely forsake you forever, but it does leave open, I might leave you in the lurch from time to time, because I'm not talking about a single event, I'm only talking about global. I don't think that would comfort us very much. I don't want to think that, I don't know, in this situation, the Lord might leave me. Now, he'll never leave me completely, but in this situation, he might leave me in the lurch. He might abandon me. I don't think so. I think he's talking about a single event here. I don't think that God is saying, globally, I'll never leave you, but you can't count on me every time because I'm only talking globally. I just don't, that doesn't make any sense to me. Then we look at the root. The "n" in front of this word means in. So I have been left in the situation. But here's how the other word is used. Now, clearly in the first one. Oh, I didn't put the first one. Okay, it's the second one. That should be first. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Clearly, that's global. Clearly, that would be an example of somebody leaving someone behind and abandoning them in the sense, I mean, you're not completely abandoning them, but the point Jesus is making is, once you leave your home, that's cut off, and you become a new family. But look at the other two. In 2 Thessalonians or 1 Thessalonians 3, when we could no longer endure it, we thought it good to be left in Athens alone. Now, was he saying Timothy and Silas had left him in the lurch and abandoned him and would never return? Or Martha was distracted with much serving, and she approached him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me," there's the word, "forsaken me to serve alone?" Now, clearly, that's a single event. So what we have is we have a cross-section. We have a cross-section. Sometimes it means a single event. Sometimes it means complete abandonment. Well, where does that leave us? Well, I think it leaves us with the possibility that the evidence is starting to move toward a single occurrence because of the Sabbath, because of the Lord's Supper, and because the Word can't prove the other. But then there's another point that we need to look at, and that's the definition of custom. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the custom or the manner of some. Well, what does that word mean? Well, it means usual practice or manner, whether established by law or otherwise, a custom, a habit, to be in the habit, habitually. Whoops. So, here's an example. According to the custom of the priesthood, his lot fell to burn incense when he went into the temple. This was something that went around and around and around. It was continuous. It was something that happened, then it happened again, then it happened again, then it happened again. That's what the word custom means. When he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. That means that every year they went for the feast of the Passover. Coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed. In other words, every time he was near the Mount of Olives, his custom was, his habit was, to go to that mountain. Then they took the body of Jesus and bound it in strips of linen with the spices as the customs of the Jews is to bury. In other words, every single person, when they die, this was their custom. So they did it to Jesus. It was done again and again and again, maybe 100 times in a day. It was a habit. Then Paul, as his custom was, went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. And then finally, not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together as the custom or manner of some is. Now, here's the problem. It can only become a habit if it's a single occurrence, repeated and repeated and repeated. Just like Zacharias went into the temple repeatedly over the years, as the custom was, he would go in by lot and he would do it again and again and again. Jesus would again and again and again go to the Mount of Olives. He wasn't living there. He didn't stay there forever. That's not what the word custom meant. What the custom meant is he went there periodically. It was something that he did. Well, here's the question. How can it be a complete apostasy and become a habit? You can't habitually fall away. You only do it one time. If it's a complete apostasy, it can't be a manner. It can't be a custom. It can't be a habit. Because you do it once, And then that's it. So if I tell you at one time I've gone to a particular place, let's say one time I've been on the train that goes out of Georgetown, but it's my habit. My habit is to get on that train. Well, how many times have you gone? Well, I've gone there once. Well, that's not a habit. If you tried cigarettes once, you didn't get in the habit of smoking cigarettes. You can't say that was a habit. You did it, and then you stopped. So how can we forsake, as a custom, if it's global? And again, I think the answer is, you can't. The only way it can become a custom is if you do it again and again and again. But by definition, if you completely apostatize, you can't do it again and again and again. You can only do it once. So I think the evidence for the single occurrence is getting weightier and weightier, and the idea of a complete and final becomes less and less likely. Because of the Sabbath, which was a one-time event. Because of the taking of the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner, which is a one-time event. Because the word forsaking can mean a one-time event or a global event, like Martha, who was left by Mary, abandoned when she's preparing this meal for Jesus. She wants to stay and listen to Jesus, and Martha feels abandoned. Well, that doesn't mean permanent. And because of the word custom, which means habit, habitually, something you do again and again and again. And I would submit to you that there's only one way you can do something again and again and again. And that's if it's a single occurrence. If you only do it once, and I don't want to belabor the point, but I think it's important. I think that when we start talking about, I know that Hebrews 10 absolutely unequivocally is only talking about the complete forsaking of an assembly forever and ever and ever, the apostasy. But it won't fit. It just won't fit. Now, am I going to make the argument that every time you miss, you've sinned? No, I'm not going to make that argument. And I'll show you why in a few moments. But I'm certainly not going to say you can't even think about Hebrews chapter 10 unless you're completely in apostasy. It doesn't apply to you. Don't even think about it. I don't think we're safe with that. I think that, again, for the reasons I've already given, we better give careful thought. You know, we only get one shot at this. When we stand before the Lord on the judgment day, if we draw a conclusion that's not correct and we live on the basis of that conclusion, we're not going to like the outcome. So, the next one, how does Jesus demand that we assess priorities? So, let's say I have to choose the assembly or work or doing something for my possessions. Well, do not lay up for yourselves treasure on earth where moth and rust consume, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Now, I'll leave it to you to assess which way the Lord would like us to go. Then we have, no one can serve two masters. He will either hate the one and love the other, or else he would loyal to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God and mammon. Now, once again, there's a priority here. A priority that, once again, we at least have to consider. I'm not saying that you can't work on the Lord's day if a situation of an emergency nature arises where you don't have any choice, but to choose to just not come, well, again, I can't answer that, but you have to think about how would you defend yourself before the Lord? Lord, I had to do it. Well, why'd you have to do it? Well, because I had to have the money to feed my family. Yeah, but didn't I tell you that you need to understand that you can't serve these two masters, that you have to serve the Lord and put the Lord first? Then we have, seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. So these are questions. Like I said, I can't answer them for you. I can answer them for me. But I want you to understand why I'm so zealous about this, why I'm so intense on this, because I think that we need to give careful consideration to it. Well, what about father and mother? Well, he that loveth father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. Probably been 43 years ago now, I'd become a Christian. My folks were really angry. They wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer. They never anticipated I'd want to be a preacher, and they didn't like it at all. And they didn't like Jeannie's parents because they felt like Jeannie's parents had ruined me. And so when they saw me spending time with them, they didn't like it. Now, I don't know if it was by design or what, but Mom decided she was going to have a meal on a Sunday evening when it was services time. And she said, "We expect you to be there." Well, I thought about it, and I told her, "Mom, the Lord is my priority. Not Jeannie's parents. The Lord is my priority. I can't come." It took years. It took almost 38 years before we finally got Mom and Dad to be baptized, because they were so upset about all of this in the beginning, they wouldn't even think about it. But I think I made the right decision. So the last thing that we want to look at is what Jesus said about the Sabbath. Now remember, the Sabbath is a type and a shadow. So we can look at this and we can kind of figure out, where's the Lord at on this? Even the Sabbath had exceptions. Now I'm not going to go into these in details, but Jesus was attacked for allowing his disciples to eat, rubbing the grain between their fingers. That was work to the Pharisees, and so he was attacked. And he was attacked on other occasions. These were his answers. When David was in a situation where the only bread was the show bread, which it was not lawful for him to eat because of the emergency situation, he ate it. Now, the Lord doesn't say whether it was right or wrong or not. And some people say, well, this is just something to throw into the Pharisees' craw, because they taught that what David did was right. So they were being hypocrites. Whether Jesus is saying it was right or not, I'm always very, very leery of creating a principle where we can set aside one of God's laws and do what we need to do because of an emergency. We call that situation ethics. If the Nazis are knocking on my door, I've got 10 Jewish children in my basement. They ask me, "Do you have any Jews here?" And I lie. And that was a completely justifiable lie. You don't even have to repent over it. Yet, God says all liars are going to be cast in the lake of fire. Now, I don't know how you feel about that. I'd have to repent. A lie is a lie. If I got myself into a situation of duress where my first point was a lie, I'd still think it was wrong. And I don't know what David did. We're not told what he did. But anyway, the Lord brings up David and the showbread. Then he brings up, you know, the priests work all day on the Sabbath. They're killing animals. They're going into the temple and offering incense. Their work day doesn't vary at all. Matter of fact, it gets a little heavier, because I think on the Sabbath day they had to sacrifice a few more animals. Jesus said, "If you knew I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not condemn the guiltless." This is a critical point. When we are dealing with people, we don't understand. They've made a decision we don't agree with. But out of mercy, we let them do it, because they're going to answer to the Lord. You remember Paul talking about this in Romans chapter 14? To his own Lord he stands or falls. Now you say, how could that be the attendance? Well, because Jesus made it part of understanding what's right and wrong on the Sabbath. He goes on to say, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And he also says, Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So, what are we saying here? What man shall there be of you that shall have one sheep, and this fall into a pit on the Sabbath day? Will he not lay hold of it and lift it out? If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, then why are you condemning me? So, here's my view. I believe that if I forsook the assembly, it would be a sin. every time I forsook the assembly. When you forsake the assembly, I'm nervous. I'm afraid. I'm concerned. Because I don't know why. And I don't know, even if I knew why, is this a legitimate reason or is this a sin? Well, you would know in your heart. I wouldn't know. Virgil's not here because he has an emergency. He can't leave his house wide open to plumbers going in and out. He's got to be there. And I don't think there's a sin there. Now, he may or may not repent. He may think in his mind, man, if I hadn't done it this way, if I'd only asked him to come tomorrow, I don't feel good about this. That's what I would do. I'd go through it in my mind, and I might ultimately say, you know, I need to tell the Lord I'm sorry, because I'm not sure whether this shows a very good priority or not. But that would be up to him, and that would be up to me. Same thing with sickness. Same thing with coming to services and seeing somebody on the side of the road. If they have a flat tire, I'd probably leave them. If they're bleeding to death, then I'm going to stop and help them, and I might miss services, and I think the Lord would understand that, and I think you would think the Lord would understand that. If I'm in a situation where my boss calls me and says, look, I'm in serious trouble. We have an emergency here. It's so serious, and you're the only one that can help, and if you don't do it, horrible things are going to happen. Oh, man, what do I do? I mean, that's an agony, just like your sheep falling into the ditch with you. Just like trying to understand, I won't be here to take the Lord's Supper. Now, I'm not talking about just morning or evening, because that's a whole different issue. We've already talked about that. I'm talking about missing the whole day. My heart would be killing me. I'd make that decision based on what I think the Lord would consider to be the higher priority, because he does say that we need to serve our masters like we serve the Lord. So if an emergency situation comes up, but what's an emergency? See, that's where the problem is. What's an emergency? Your emergency might not be my emergency. But to his own Lord, he stands or falls. So when we talk about forsaking an assembly, I don't think we're talking complete apostasy. I think we're talking individual. I don't think we get a pass here is what I'm saying. I think that if we're forced to miss, we have to agonize over it. We have to think about priorities. We have to think about penalties. We have to think about the Sabbath. We have to think about all of these considerations. And if we're not even thinking about those things, I'm going to be knocking on your door saying, are you thinking about these things? And if you get mad because we're reasoning together, well, that shows you're not really convicted on your position. If you know, I don't get mad at people when I'm studying about baptism with them. I know that I hold the truth. And if they start making these arguments, I just listen. Well, why get mad? So, as we wind down this lesson, forsaking an assembly is dangerous. I'll just leave it at that. It's dangerous. Because it shows the Lord our true priorities. We don't know for certain if it's a single time, but the evidence points in that direction, and so it can't be entered lightly. When people take a job that requires them to miss once a month, twice a month, three times a month, every week, where's the line? I think that if I took a job and I could never attend services again, you'd certainly say, well, Alan, that's a violation. Well, what about three times a month, or twice a month, or once a month? That's a hard question. I can't answer it for you. But don't take it lightly, because your soul is at stake. The penalties for taking the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner are clearly compounded if we forsake an assembly. And finally, God is watching. Well, not finally, there's one more. But God is watching our heart and our priorities. If we get it wrong, choose our life or our possessions over Him, we're going to have to answer for it. So I'm going to always teach that it's better to change jobs and make sacrifices to attend the services. Now, you may say, well, you don't understand my situation. And you're right, I don't. So we're not going to withdraw from somebody for doing that. But we are going to let them know. You may lose your soul for that decision. And so you can look at all this material. It'll be posted on the website this next week, and you can listen to the sermon again. I think that we have a pretty good case that forsaking the assembly is dangerous, and that we better not enter into it lightly. And when in doubt, we're going to have to repent and ask for forgiveness, and not just cavalierly say or indifferently say, that verse has nothing to do with my situation. I didn't completely fall away, so I don't even have to think about that verse. That verse doesn't apply to me. I think that that is not true, and it's very dangerous. And so, brethren, as we wind down this series, it's been a series of three lessons. I felt like it needed to be preached because, as I say, some accusations have been made, some statements that needed to be addressed. The church here, as far as I know, has no policy, but individuals here have convictions, and I have convictions, and I will share them. So if there's anyone in the audience who has been moved in any way by this lesson or other lessons and feels the need that they need to make their life right with God in a public way, then this is the time we set aside for brethren to do that. And if you're here this morning as a Christian and you'd like, or excuse me, as an unbeliever or a non-member or an unbaptized individual, we would like to give you the opportunity to become a Christian today, because today is a day of salvation. If we can be any help to anyone in any way, we invite you to come while we together stand and sing.